This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. In 1898, Edward Elgar had just begun to break out from being a provincial composer writing works for hire to a world-famous artist, thanks to the Imperial March he had written for Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. He wrote at the time that he was possessed by the idea of writing a symphony on the life and character of General Charles Gordon, the hero of the British campaigns in China and Khartoum. But nothing ever came of that idea, and Elgar didn't get back to thinking about writing a symphony for 10 years. Johannes Brahms didn't write his first symphony until he was in his 40s, the latest any major composer had taken that important step up to that point. Brahms had spent his life struggling primarily against the ghost of Beethoven and against the expectations placed on him by his mentor, Robert Schumann. Elgar's struggles were not only internal, but external as well. His biographer called him a hypersensitive, touchy, moody, at times almost suicidally unhappy genius with small, nervous hands, an English eccentric who loved fishing, dogs, recondite information, and bonfires, who practiced chemistry, and who nursed within him a wound that never healed, end quote. Elgar was poor and mostly self-taught, with a massive inferiority complex about his humble origins. He had married above his station to a woman 8 years his senior, and he was Catholic at a time when anti-Roman sentiment in England was at a peak. He had struggled to earn a living as a musician, and when he decided to thank all the people who had stood by him during the lean years in a piece of music, he was finally rewarded when it became an international hit, his Enigma Variations of 1899. Finally, he had the opportunity to concentrate on composing, unencumbered by financial constraints, and 9 years and a string of successes later, he finally returned to the idea of writing a symphony. But unlike his younger contemporaries, Ralph Vaughan Williams and Gustav Holst, Elgar's symphony was not inspired by a return to the roots of English folk song and dance. It was unabashedly continental, with wild mood swings from the profane to the mystical and from deep melancholy to ecstatic joy that led some to refer to Elgar as the English Mahler. Given that their personalities were similar as well, the comparison is not that far from the truth. The opening tune is the emblem of Elgar's first symphony. It returns throughout the piece in different guises, sometimes boldly, sometimes like a ghost. It's the kind of big tune that Elgar became famous for, like Nimrod in the Enigma Variations or the Pomp and Circumstance Marches. At the beginning, Elgar gives it to us twice, first quietly, with only the tune and its staccato bass, then in a large fortissimo. It's the kind of tune that unfolds seemingly effortlessly, and yet at the same time, unpredictably. Even the unexpected harmonic changes seem right. but suddenly Elgar plunges into an impassioned allegro. This is music as restless, changeable, and nervous as the opening was stable and consistent. That opening melody returns at crucial moments, but almost always quietly, like a whisper. It's a distant reminder of another world, another life, another way. Once, it rises to fortissimo, but against ruthless interference from most of the orchestra. This movement is full of pushing and pulling as the opening struggles to reestablish itself. Finally, at the end, it does, but pianissimo, with ghost music, creeping shadows, and darting flecks of light. The second movement is a whipping scherzo. But with yet another big tune. The contrasting central section, which comes along twice, is scored delicately, almost like chamber music. Elgar wanted it played like something you hear down by the river. When the scherzo returns for the last time, its momentum gradually winds down. Until Elgar slips the key relationships yet again to start the great adagio. The notes are exactly the same as those at the end of the scherzo, but now, in Michael Kennedy's words, becalmed into a melody of limitless consolatory powers. Hans Richter, who conducted the premiere of this symphony, was one of the first modern conductors to discourage applause between movements. But the adagio broke down the audience's and Richter's reserve, and the conductor called Elgar to the stage to acknowledge the storm of cheers and hand clapping. The composer's friend August Jaeger, Nimrod of the Enigma Variations, later wrote to Elgar that it was not only one of the very greatest slow movements since Beethoven, but worthy of that master. Yeager also said that with this melody, which appears towards the movement's end, we are brought near heaven. But the music that begins the finale is, as Elgar said, music of shuddering dread, cold dismay, pang of heart. The sounds are as dark as those of the Adagio were radiant. You can hear the symphony's opening melody faintly behind the chilly gusts and ominous footsteps, but once again it is roughly swept aside by another restless and forceful allegro. The finale is another movement full of event and contrast, visited by specters. At last, the grand melody steps forward, not as a ghost, but in a blaze. The orchestra tries to crush it as furious waves of sound break on it. In the end, the tune prevails, but only just. Leaving us with what is perhaps the most ambiguous grand finale to any symphony, and one of the most moving. The premiere of Elgar's Symphony No. 1 was a triumph. The next day, Richter traveled to London to prepare the work with the London Symphony. He told them, "Let us now rehearse the greatest symphony of modern times, and not only in this country." Within that first year, it was performed no less than 80 times, from London to St. Petersburg to Sydney to Boston and New York. Did Elgar exorcise his demons the way Brahms had? He had been knighted in 1904 and was respected not only as a composer, but as a critic and educator. But his celebrity was a mixed blessing. He complained to his friend Yeager that, "My life is one continual giving up of the little things that I love." It was only a year later that his fame began to wane, and when his second symphony premiered in London in 1911, it was received politely, but less than enthusiastically. But in the late 20s and 30s, aging and in poor health, he was rediscovered, and he even made recordings of most of his major works, including this symphony. It is a remarkable document. And you could even call it the last testament of a composer finally at peace with himself. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.